Today's episode is sponsored by HelloFresh. For me, and no doubt for you, life is always super busy, and I love the fact that HelloFresh provides all the fresh seasonal ingredients and step-by-step recipe cards to make wonderful meals. And even better, they're delivered straight to your door whenever suits you. What is there not to like? And this month, there's a range of choices: premium recipes, childhood classics, family recipes, meals under 650 calories, and quick ones that take under 15 minutes to prepare. Perfect for you after a busy day, or if, like me, you are anxious to eat quickly to keep watching that new true crime documentary. Yep, we've all been there. I had two great meals in particular this week from HelloFresh. I choose to eat vegetarian food, and there is just so much choice. Even this week, let me tell you two of the dishes I had. Firstly, pasta primavera with lemon sauce, bell pepper, zucchini and peas. Beautiful. And also the sweet potato and pepper quesadillas with Southwest crema and tomato sauce. Just how good were they? And all the ingredients are so fresh. Go on, give them a try. Visit hellofresh.co.uk today and use my code UKTrueCrime to get 60% off your first box and 25% off your next 2 months. That's UK True Crime for new and customers who cancelled at least 12 months ago. Remember, use UK True Crime today. Hello and welcome to episode 383 of the UK True Crime podcast. I'm Adam. Thank you for joining me today for this story from the county where I grew up in Hertfordshire. It's a story which is, well, almost literally straight out of a true crime novel, as you will see when we begin. A huge thank you to my good friend and author Chris Wood for researching and writing the episode this week. Okay, so let's set some context of our guest the month and year game. Number 2 in the UK charts was Madonna with Crazy For You. In the US top spot was Whitney Houston with All The Man That I Need. And in Australia, the number 1 song for 4 weeks was British dance band London Beat with I've Been Thinking About You. Remember that one? In the news this month, John Grisham published his second novel, The Firm. South African President F.W. de Klerk said he would repeal all apartheid laws. The Silence of the Lambs was released, starring Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster. The first Gulf War began as US-led forces began Operation Desert Saber, the ground invasion of southern Iraq and Iraqi-occupied Kuwait. I was blissfully unaware of this in Bangkok, waiting for my Kuwaiti Airlines back to the UK, which I realised was cancelled on arrival at the airport. Those were the days before mobile phones. And just to make you feel really old, if you were alive, Ed Sheeran was born this month. So did you get the month and year? It was February 1991. Ah well, it was a tricky one, there's no shame there. Today's story is from the Hertfordshire town of Hemel Hempstead, some 24 miles northwest of London. The town is home to a truly horrible roundabout, worse than the one in Colchester, known as the Magic Roundabout, and anyone that's driven on it will testify to that. Perhaps this contributed in part to the town rather cruelly being awarded Britain's Ugliest Town in 2013. 43-year-old businessman John Warrington, he lived in Hemel Hempstead. He was a man who loved to be involved in all manner of projects and schemes. A former grammar schoolboy, he was primarily known as a property developer, owning several commercial shop premises and 2 homes. These assets, however, began tumbling in value as the property market collapse hit the UK in 91. And having been in a seemingly enviable position, John and his wife Jennifer were now feeling not so much a financial squeeze but more of an asphyxiation, lapsing into debts totalling around £755,000, a number which was soaring by over £1,000 each week. Today this is a huge sum, right? And 30 years ago it was so much more. This was really tough for him as he, his wife and children had got used to living a certain lifestyle, as we all do, depending on our incomes, and of course he didn't want any of this to go away. When it came to making money, John Warrington was open to anything. I think we all know someone like this, don't we? If there was even a sniff that something could prove fruitful and potentially lucrative, he would discount nothing. So feeling down on his luck and desperate to clear his debts, he adopted a very different method to try and make some serious quick money. As a means of avoiding bankruptcy, turning to writing thriller novels is perhaps not the conventional way of making some rapid cash. There is some precedent here, I guess, when you think of someone like Jeffrey Archer, who back in 1974 wrote his first book, and from this point it led to fame, wealth, and so much more. Probably best not to go there. Maybe in another episode. Never one to be afraid of the adverse odds stacked against him, John Warrington put his creativity to the test and began penning his own thriller novel in the hope that publishers would take him on and that his financial security would be assured. So he sat at his desk and he busily set about writing his novel, which he named Strawberry Fair, which was a tale involving an impoverished antiques dealer on the verge of suicide before turning to blackmail. There were parts of the book which mirrored John's family life. For example, his wife Jenny ran an antiques business, which was part of John's portfolio at this time. Now, if you have ever written a book, you will know that sending off a manuscript to a publisher can be a nerve-wracking thing to do. There's no getting away from it. You're being judged, right? And unless you are established or some sort of third-rate celeb, it's also utterly thankless with rejections, if you receive any response at all. For John Warrington, the stakes were high and a lot rested on his quality of his written work. But having waited for weeks on end, the publishers finally came back to him, but not with the news that he wanted. They all decided they would not be taking his manuscript for publication, and so bringing to an end not only his newly started writing career, but also to him it seemingly ended his final desperate attempt to avoid losing his home and the multiple assets that he owned, and his lifestyle. With an expectant notice of foreclosure and the imminent repossession of his house, John trawled his desperate mind in a search for a last-minute reprieve. His book would never see the light of day on a Waterstone shelf, but it didn't mean it couldn't be of any use to him. The bulk of the plot for Strawberry Fair centred around a kidnap attempt, which involved the extortion of vast sums of money from a wealthy businessman. There seemed to him only one answer to his problems, and he decided to turn the fictional pages of his book into reality. He needed to select a victim for his ploy, someone who, if the job was to be worthwhile, was dripping with wealth, and he thought he'd found just the right person. In 1991, Luton Town Football Club were rubbing shoulders with the footballing elite such as the mighty Leeds United in the First Division, now the Premier League. Their deputy chairman was a man named Roger Smith, and while his footballing role took up a lot of his time and attention, he was also very successful in other business ventures, including being the chairman of the Tremoco Motor Company Group. Being a man of such wealth, Roger Smith was often asked to sponsor a whole range of events, both locally and nationally. One such occasion saw him sponsor a village horse trial in 1981. For him, it was just another event, but in the end, it had a huge effect on his life. Despite the passing of 10 years since that event, it had nonetheless left an indelible mark on John Warrington, who'd been in attendance at the horse trial that day. Perhaps he'd felt jealousy as he watched how the Smith family were the centre of attention at the horse day. But the one thing he took from it was that Roger Smith was indeed a very wealthy man, a multi-millionaire, and John had never forgotten this. John Warrington subsequently turned his focus completely towards Roger Smith and planning his proposed crime with precision. He used hire cars to drive to the Smiths' large home in Markeygate, Hertfordshire, not too far from where he lived, getting ready to implement his plan. He took his task seriously and he would sit and watch the house intently, monitoring and recording in great detail the times that the cleaners would come and go and the time that the family would be out. And crucially to his plan, he checked at what point in the week Margaret Smith, Roger's wife, was home alone. Also living at the property were the couple's three children, 27-year-old Ian, 25-year-old Joanna, and the youngest child, Sally, who was 12. Following his surveillance of the family home, John knew it was time to put his plan into effect. To do this, he bought handcuffs and a cassette recorder, before calling in at Harrods in London to buy the final instrument that surely every single serious criminal needs. A £23 electronic voice distorter toy. But more on this later. Having prepared meticulously, Warrington believed that his plan was ready to be effected and put into place. Just before noon on the 28th of February 1991, Margaret Smith was in the kitchen ironing her husband's shirt. A devoted charity worker, she was due to have her head done in the afternoon in readiness for a glitzy ball at London's Savoy Hotel later that evening. Any excitement she was feeling for that event quickly evaporated when she was suddenly aware she wasn't alone. From apparently nowhere, someone, John Warrington, wearing a blue balaclava with iron mouth slits and wearing a navy boiler suit and trainers, confronted her. He was holding a replica gun and a four-pronged pitchfork, perhaps to ward off any attack from the family dog. Speaking rapidly, Warrington, who was unknown to Margaret, demanded money from her. Hoping to appease him quickly, she took out three £10 notes and handed them over and asked him to leave. Refusing, he then turned far more aggressive and violent. She pleaded for him not to kill her. She feared this is what he planned to do. And she told him she had three children that needed her. Warrington snapped at this, yelling, "Shut up or I'll kill you. On the floor, hands behind your back." With Margaret now in this position, he pressed the pitchfork into her shoulder blades to demonstrate that he really meant business. She then felt the handcuffs clicking around her wrists, and she was forcefully bundled from her house and into a waiting car. As she was put into the boot of the car, her fears were heightened further when she saw an axe was placed there. But Warrington just drove the car around for the remainder of the afternoon. Perhaps he was trying to consider his next move, his mind muddled from the chaos he'd created. And it was not until 6:30 p.m, some 6 hours after Margaret's ordeal had begun, that he finally stopped driving. He pulled on the balaclava and boiler suit once again. He opened the car boot and spoke to his kidnapped victim using the toy voice distorter he'd earlier purchased. He told her she'd be spending the rest of the night in the boot before slamming the door shut again and driving round once more before eventually parking up. She was given a quick drink of water and then simply abandoned to the darkness of the airless boot. The next time she'd see her kidnapper was not until 7 a.m. the following morning. It goes without saying that Margaret must have had a terrible, horrendous night. Totally oblivious to where she was or what would happen next. And of course knowing that the family would have no idea where she was or if she would even see them again. Back at the family home, Roger Smith had returned back expecting to find his wife getting ready for the charity dinner. Instead, he found the ironing board with a half-ironed shirt on it, with the iron still switched on. On the floor was his wife's purse, still with money inside. He called the hairdresser, who confirmed that his wife had not kept her appointment that afternoon. Her red BMW was still on the driveway. Coupled with no sign whatsoever of his wife, he was overcome with panic and knew something was very wrong. At 5:40 p.m. he received a strange phone call. It was difficult to make out what the caller was saying, but he could identify that the voice said 11 p.m. This was of course Warrington making the call and using the voice distortion toy. He made his demands, but this made his demands very difficult to comprehend. Roger of course suspected it was a kidnap attempt. Too many things just didn't sit right. The phone call, even not being able to understand most of it, was the final factor that convinced him that he needed to call the police. At the time the apparent ransom call was made, Margaret had already been removed from the boot of the car, where she'd been for more than 12 hours. A bin liner was placed over her head and she was led up some wooden steps with no idea where she was being led. She was actually taken to a dingy storeroom, two floors above the Carousel Antique Shop on Hemel Hempstead High Street, owned by Warrington. The windows were boarded up and the room was bare and cold. Margaret was chained to a radiator and floorboard joist and presented with a bucket for a toilet. She was blindfolded through the whole procedure. Meanwhile, the police set up an incident room. Operation Kiwi was launched, which saw almost 200 officers tasked with finding Margaret. The police operation went undercover, and detectives asked for Anir's blackout so they didn't alert the potentially skittish kidnapper if he was nervous, as they suspected. It didn't deter Warrington from phoning again the very next day. Once more, using the voice toy as a disguise, the menacing mystery voice demanded £500,000 for the safe release of Margaret Smith. Now, as we know, Roger Smith was very wealthy, but this wasn't an amount which he could quickly get his hands on, and he told the caller that it would take time to raise this amount. And the following day, the blackmailer called again, and this time dropped his ransom by half to £250,000, suggesting it was an amateur and a desperate one at that. On Monday the 4th of March, following yet another call, Roger Smith was told to collect a tape that had been left at a spot in the nearby village of Gaddesden Row. Along with his eldest son Ian, the pair found the tape inside a small cake box on top of concrete pillars. On the tape, Roger was warned that if police intervened and were present at the payoff spot, I quote, "it would do the lady a great disservice." Also in the background on this tape, his stricken wife could be heard saying, "this can't go on for much longer. I'm sure you are doing all you can to help me. Keep your spirits up, and I will try to do the same. God bless all of you, and lots of love." If there was any consolation here, it was that Margaret Smith was seemingly still alive. That night, the family and police listened repeatedly to the tape and the strange voice that was dictating instructions to them. They dubbed the perpetrator the Dalek, owing to the way that the voice distortion toy had altered the voice to sound similar to the creatures from the TV show Doctor Who. Senior officers met into the early hours discussing the developments contained in the message and took the steps of calling in a psychologist and a linguist expert to examine the tape. Roger Smith and his three children spent their fifth night in limbo at their home, desperately wondering what would happen next, and hoping beyond hope that the police, of all of the resources they were ploughing into the operation, would soon come up with a breakthrough. Then at 6:30 a.m. the following morning, that breakthrough did occur in the most unexpected manner. Now, as we heard earlier, it was the plot of a fictional book which helped to inspire this chain of events. And as we all know, every good story needs a hero. In this case, the hero came in a very unexpected guise. Pint-sized milkman, Bert Joyce. He was only just about 5 foot tall. He was fondly nicknamed Bert the Squirt. A real throwback to yesteryear. Now, if you're old enough, do you remember your old milkman? No doubt whistling through the coldest of mornings, always chirping, happy to help. This was just how Bert Joyce was each day. Whilst doing his milk rounds on Hemel Hempstead High Street, he became aware of some strange, muffled cries saying, help me, coming from the antique shop. Thankfully, the cheery milkman didn't just put it down to kids or pass it off for some other innocuous reason, which is what we hear a lot on this podcast, don't we? Instead, he called 999, which in turn sent armed officers racing to the shop. Within 10 minutes, there were officers at the site and able to confirm they'd found Margaret Smith chained up and alone. The officers who first arrived on the scene had no equipment to cut Margaret free from the manacles that she'd been chained to for almost 5 days. A pair of bolt cutters were quickly collected from a local police station and used to cut the half-inch thick nylon chains which had bound her arms and ankles. There was no sign, however, of Margaret Smith's kidnapper at the property. Incredibly, for the majority of the time that Warrington had kept his victim imprisoned, he'd been living a normal life, still taking his two children to and from school and keeping up his image of the family man and hard-working businessman. His unsuspecting wife Jenny had continued to work in the antique store, unaware that Margaret was being kept only two floors above her. Jenny never had any reasons to go into premises above the shop, and so she remained totally oblivious to the drama playing out above her. Warrington was actually caught while sauntering through Hemel Hempstead, having dropped his children off at school, as he was arrested by officers. He made no efforts to claim innocence, admitting freely and immediately that the prospect of facing financial oblivion had forced him into the crime. He also told the armed police who arrested him, "I wish you had shot me," 43-year-old Warrington was remanded in custody at Hemel Hempstead. He faced three charges: kidnapping Margaret Smith, assaulting her, and unlawfully imprisoning her in some secret and private place, and making demands with menaces that she would not be returned safely until monies had been paid to him. Warrington's solicitor made no application for bail, so now, ironically, it was Warrington's turn to face incarceration. As we've heard, Warrington fancied himself as a writer, and now he had lots of time on his hands to do this. When awaiting trial, he even penned a letter to his victim. It read, "You're free at last. You will never know how much I suffered with you. I couldn't put any effort into what I was doing because my whole person was being torn apart. We knew each other briefly and exchanged so few words, but clearly you're a lady of the highest calibre. Please don't think badly of my family. My wife is also a great lady, and my son and daughter are fine people. Just unfortunate to have a cavalier loser for a dad. You may learn to understand that this whole hideous affair was born out of research into crime fiction. It was just unfortunate that my world collapsed and fantasy became fudged with reality. Planning it was so easy because it wasn't real. I drank a bottle of scotch for I could do it. Your ideal was short, and I'm sure that you will live each day of your life a little fuller for it. Good luck, and I'm sorry, John." Meanwhile, a couple of days after her release, Margaret expressed her desire to meet her hero milkman, Bert Boyce. When the pair met, his first words to her were, "I'm sorry I didn't hear you on the Monday." Stiff and limping following her five-day ordeal, Margaret simply thanked him for saving her life. At St Albans Crown Court, John Warrington pleaded guilty to the charges that lay before him. Hearing from Margaret Smith, the court were given a glimpse into the reality of the hell that she had faced, and the psychological battle in her own mind of the prospects of whether her life would be spared or if she would be killed. She described how when she was first moved to the storeroom, she watched in horror as her jailer began to prise up the floor. "I thought I was going to be murdered and buried there," she said. In fact, Warrington was merely exposing a floor joist from which he could chain the handcuffs to Margaret. She also explained how towards the end of her captivity, she tried to learn from her kidnapper what her fate was going to be. "I asked him if I was going to die. He replied, 'I won't kill you. You've been as good as gold.'" The court also heard how Warrington fed her only two biscuits, a handful of Polo mints, and gulps of bottled water over the five-day period. Magnanimously, Margaret said she had sympathy for the defendant's wife and family, but as well as all of the psychological scarring she'd have to live with, she said that her kidnapper left her with an intense fear of the dark and of being alone. On the 15th of July 1991, John Warrington was jailed for 15 years. The judge told him, "These offences strike at the very root of other people's lives and their ability to live peacefully and without fear." In an unusual move and recognising what must have been an appalling ordeal, he also paid tribute to Margaret Smith by awarding her with a token award of £100 to be paid to her as a mark of public recognition of her courage. The move astonished Margaret, saying, "I shall certainly give it to some worthier cause than myself." Quite the contrast between Margaret and the man in the dock. Margaret even expressed surprise at the length of sentence that her kidnapper had received. Of the sentence, she said, "I know that it was a very awful thing that happened, but I didn't really expect that length of time." While in prison in Brixton, John Warrington was understood to have made an attempt at his own life. Once again, it kind of involved writing. By wedging a pen in the crack of a door, he lunged himself at the pointed tip. Like the kidnap, this bid failed, and Warrington remained to serve out his time at Her Majesty's pleasure. So what do you make of what we've heard today? It's an incredible story, isn't it? Where one man's foray into writing fiction so alarmingly became the plot for a real-life terror campaign. This in itself seems worthy of a TV drama, doesn't it? What strikes me is the absolute contrast between John Warrington and his victim Margaret Smith. I suppose they were both going through different times. Warrington struggling for money, Margaret Smith very comfortable. But at the time of the story, they're two very different people with very different moral compasses, but forever linked by a very cowardly and terrifying experience, driven by the age-old desire for the greed of money. I'd love to know what happened to John Warrington after he left prison, but I've not been able to find out. I'd love to know what happened to his family. Did they lose the home? I guess they did. I don't know. Did his wife stay with him? It's hard to know. And I wonder if the antiques business is still there and thriving in the ugly town, or voted the ugly town, of Hemel Hempstead. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of the UK True Crime Podcast. To discuss this story and any other aspects of UK true crime, please head to Facebook? Where am I from? Facebook. And join over 94,000 of us who talk UK true crime 24/7. Come and join us today. And to support the show, please do head to patreon.com/UK True Crime for bonus episodes. There are 74, number 75 is happening this week. And there's loads of other exclusive content, competitions. There's about to be a discounted access to Professor David Wilson's criminology course. I'm afraid the two free courses have been won. Please do join our community at Patreon. That's patreon.com/UK True Crime and help me continue to release free weekly content. A huge thank you to the latest members of this community. That's Wendy Clarkson, Joe Earnshaw, Sarah, and Emma Juby. Thank you so much. So that's all for me for another week. Adam, the host of the UK's 37th most popular true crime podcast. Huge thank you to Chris Wood for the story. Really enjoyed it. If you can, please do support my sponsor, HelloFresh. It's a great product. And if you do so, it keeps advertisers spending some money with independent podcasters like me. So until we speak again next week, please do take it easy. And remember, despite all the others, you know it, stay classy. Cheerio for now.